And we can't play any more of that song.
Because it gets more and more inappropriate after that. So that's the most appropriate 33 seconds that we can play of that song. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Drive Thru HR. Thank you for letting us invade your ear holes. Today it's Nisha and myself. Brian is traveling, I believe he's in Ohio, and I believe it's even more specific, he's in Dayton. Dayton, as some would say. So we wish him the best, safest travels, and hopefully we will see him later on this week. But we have a wonderful guest, and I can't wait to kind of get into what is going on in his world. So, Jonathan, would you do us a favor and kind of introduce yourself to the audience?
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I've had the privilege to listen to the show. I didn't know I would someday be on. I am a management lawyer in Philadelphia, and I am a recovering litigator. I did that for a long time, and now my entire focus is on the preventive, with a particular emphasis on diversity, harassment, discrimination, retaliation, EEO, generally speaking, wage and hour issues, social media issues, and traditional labor issues with the National Labor Relations Board.
Now, the recovering, do you all have meetings? Do you kind of get together? Is there any type of support group that you've now joined because you're of the recovering litigator?
Well, you know, those of us who are in recovery, we see every once in a while something coming out of the courtroom, and we see that look in their eye. So we do interventions, and we let them know that there is life after court. But I have to tell you, the slip rate is very high because the intensity of being in court and before a jury, it can be a very, very strong lure when you have on the other side lawyers who are saying, hey, we're not into the excitement. We're into avoiding it. We want to keep our clients out of trouble. You know, people that are into the excitement love the litigation.
Yeah, I was about to say, they love the juice. Yeah, they love the juice coming from the courtroom, and you've now crossed over to success for me is never getting to the courtroom.
To me, the definition of success, I never forgot a general counsel said to me, tell me about your biggest win. And I told him about a case that went away for nothing. We solved the problem. He said, no, I mean a win. I mean, and I thought, you mean something where you spent $250,000 and won? I thought the best one is where you paid nothing and won.
Well, technically, you were right on that one. let's get in, because I do want to ask you what's keeping you up at night, and also your clients. So it's kind of a two-pronged. You know, what's keeping you up at night, and what's top of mind for you these days, and then let's kind of pivot that into what are you seeing from your clients, what's kind of keeping them up at night, etc.
Well, right now, and it's an interesting time, there are a couple things that are keeping both, you know, keeping my clients up at night, keeping me up at night, so I'm really careful. All separately, I should note, is that the National Labor Relations Board and some of the changes that we are likely to see occur in 2014. Now, I have to divert, if I can, and do 1 second of what I do outside of work, and I promise it actually relates to the labor board. My passion outside of law, and I am passionate about HR and what it means, is animal rescue, helping older cats and dogs who have really nothing but love to give and want nothing but love and recur, getting them second chances in animal shelters, my local SPCA. And as a result of doing it for 9 years, I probably don't have enough fear of animals. I'm really not afraid of them. Maybe sometimes they should be. But the only thing that really scares me is a rabid dog, because when I see a rabid dog, it is a frightening sight. I saw myself on video talking about the NLRB, and I saw that rabid dog. So I'm going to do my best to talk about the NLRB without being too rabid. We know of all the cases where the NLRB is saying common work rules like be respectful may violate the National Labor Relations Act, because a reasonable person might think that interferes with concerted activity, which is a precursor often to union activity. I think that's rather extreme. We're aware of the cases where the NLRB is protecting employees who are bad-mouthing an employer by social media. I understand the one-on-one. This is unfair, and I see why the law protects that. But I wonder if the NLRB ever thought, gee, if an employee is really successful and bad-mouths the employer so that no one wants to go near the employer, they lose some of their customer base. Does the NLRB realize that to protect one employee's angry voice, jobs may be lost if customers flee? We're kind of getting used to those cases, but now I think in 2014 we're going to see new election rules. They were promulgated in, I believe, 2011 initially, and they were struck down by the courts. And are you familiar with most of the justices on the Supreme Court?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay. So you're familiar, of course, with or at least the district courts. So you'd be familiar with Judge Woody Allen? Judge Woody Allen was cited in striking down the court. And the election rules, the court began by saying, Woody Allen said 90% of life is showing up. No one showed up. There's no quorum. Well, now we have a quorum of five. So we can expect expedited election rules, which always work to the advantage of unions, or almost always, because they can spend 6 months, 9 months building a case, making an argument, sometimes spreading untruths, playing on emotion, and the employer may have 3 weeks to turn it around. The second thing we see the union, the NLRB doing, is approving micro-units. They don't like that term, I think because it says it what it is, but smaller units, and the smaller the unit, the easier it is for the union to organize. So it could be a position, it could be a department, it was a shoe department in one case, it could be an accounting group in another case. So if you have an unhappy group of employees, that department, that shift, that position could be a unit. And that gets the union in the door. And now they're talking about, come March, persuader rules that would, in my view, rewrite the law, which I don't think is the job of the NLRB, to say, I always understood a persuader as someone who persuades to the employees and says, this is why we think you're better off without a union, without engaging in threats, interrogations, promises, surveillance, retaliation, etc. But it didn't include someone that educated managers on the rights, on what their rights are, what they can say and what they can't say. That's, you know, that's would never consider direct influence. The expectation is that coming forward, employers are going to have to report that kind of training to the government, as well as other policies or programs, if they may, such as an engagement survey, have a one of the goals to help a company stay union-free. I mean, most engagement programs, that's one of the goals. So I think that's going to be met with substantial resistance. It's going to keep a lot of people up at night. It invades the attorney-client privilege, and I think I'm about to get rabbits. Let me just wipe off some of the saliva.
I want to dig into micro-units because I just learned about this. I was at a conference in November for the restaurant and food service industry, and they had some wonderful employment attorneys there kind of explaining what's kind of going on in the industry and kind of some of the things that they're seeing, et cetera. And again, not being a lawyer and kind of seeing this stuff from the sidelines, this is kind of an amazing little twist. What should the audience know even more about where you see the micro units either going or stalling out or kind of the future of that over the next couple of years? What's your take on micro units?
You know, I think the labor board, unlike other government agencies, has gone from being an adjudicative body to an advocacy body where its goal is transparent. And there are statistics that show unions win more the smaller the unit may be. So I think you're going to begin to see smaller units in restaurants, in long-term care facilities, in manufacturing, in white-collar settings as well. And a lot of times, if you think of a wall-to-wall unit, everybody that works for the department store, it may be hard for the union to get 30% of the people to sign cards, And they usually want 50 because some people will sign cards just to get the union to go away. I mean, if I told you I'm going to tell you the history of ERISA, you might sign a card just to make me go away. So people will sign cards to make the union go away. So they usually need 50%. It's hard to get 15% if a store has 800, 1,000 people. But what if you pick a shoe department? In one case, it wasn't shoes. It was just women's shoes. In effect, what I view micro units is gerrymandering the workforce where there is the strongest union support in trying to represent those employees. And I think you're going to see unions where their numbers are dropping. Remember, in the 50s, 1 in 3 private sector employees was represented by a union. Today, that number is less than 7%. So I think you're going to see gerrymandering of units where they think it favors the union. And a labor board.
Let me ask about how unions are popularized by sports. All the major sports, you know, NFL, baseball, basketball, hockey, etc. They all have unions. The players all have unions. What's your take on how that either, you know, helps unions and popularizes the concept of a union, or maybe works against them in a strike year, et cetera? Like, what's your take on the sports world and unions?
Well, it's a great question, and you could probably almost say the same issue for the entertainment world. You have people that are earning at the top end of the income spectrum in a union. And I think that's, in many respects, for historical and political reasons, less than necessarily economic reasons. I mean, in sports, we all know everyone's a free agent, and the same thing is pretty much true in Hollywood. So I don't know if the average person thinks, okay, you know, baseball player or football player makes X, that's because of the union. I don't think the two are connected, and I don't think it really has a material effect on how employees will perceive a union. But it is kind of interesting that you have really the top end of the pay scale, people in a union. I think it's less for economic than for other reasons.
And you mentioned EEOC and also social earlier. What's the relationship? Because I used to say that social, the way that people actually interact with social in HR and especially in recruiting, if you were to talk to a recruiter offline, they would tell you they look at everything. They look at Google profile. They're going to Google the person. They're going to look at their Facebook posts. They're going to look at everything. They're going to know everything about that, even in the protected class scenarios. They're going to know everything about a candidate. Now, they would never say that on the record, but off the record, they would tell you that in practice, they use all that stuff to figure out who to bring in and who to hire and who to interview and all that stuff. So how is the relationship between EEO right now and social? What's your kind of take, 2013?
Yeah.
Here's what it really looks like. Okay.
Well, let me tell you, this is an area where, you know, this is another one that keeps me up at night, because – It's very easy for people just to press a button and to tweet to the world. And on the other hand, there are some HR people that are hearing lawyers go risk, 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 and then they're afraid to do anything. And that can be as dangerous, because if you look at the millennial workers, many of them are not getting their information from, or it's getting primary information from social media. So I think to ignore it can be very dangerous. To me, it's not whether, but how. Let me give you a couple of examples. Every employer that's responsible wants to try to develop as diverse a group as possible, reflecting the talent in the diverse communities. Of course, always hire the most qualified, but in a diverse world, you'll have a more diverse, should have a more diverse applicant pool. How do you get there? Well, in LinkedIn, if you put in the search field and you put nurse and you put virtually any ethnic, religious, racial, or other name before nurse, you'll find a nursing group geared toward that. And you can do that in almost any industry. So one potentially valuable use of LinkedIn is to find associations that are composed of individuals in which the members are historically underrepresented in your workplace. number one, it has the business value of tapping into that talent. And number two, it has the legal value. If someone says, you're discriminating against me because I am Hispanic, you could say, really? But I tapped into the Hispanic Nurses Association. Doesn't that kind of seem inconsistent? So what's good business is also a good legal defense. In terms of the actual hiring process, this is where I come out. And it's somewhere between the extremes, which I think are usually extremely wrong. One is, look at anything you can get in the pre-employment process, because there's always a higher risk in firing someone than in not hiring them. And I think that's a bit cavalier, because you may not even want to consider someone, but once you know their age or their race or their likely religion, they may assume that's the reason why you have decided not to hire them. On the other hand, if I've interviewed you and I'm in the final step of it and I'm decided, look, I want to hire Jane Doe, but before I do, I want to check her social media site. Only something that's public. Oh, I would never ask her for her social media password, never ask anyone else what's on there, but see what's publicly available. And I see that she's posted racist, ageist, ethnic slurs. Boy, am I glad that I asked. Is there a modest risk? I guess so. Maybe she'll mention something that wasn't visible when I met her. But most of what's, quote, you don't want to know when you screen, you already know when you're making the final decision. Likely age, potential religion, gender, things along those natures. So the risk is lower later in the process, and the benefit may be higher. So I think at the end of the process, if HR, not the manager, and HR tells the managers, don't you look, we'll look if appropriate. And if it's appropriate, then I'm a big believer in printing it out, circling what's inappropriate, and putting it in the file, so if there's something on there that's protected, the person celebrating a recovery anniversary, the person having trouble with medication, you can be clear that's what you're thinking about. You're not what you're thinking about. You're focusing on the slurs. You're focusing on the very bad judgment. One individual's case, an employer was looking to hire, and the person put on their Facebook page had a lot of comments, and every other word was the F word. And they weren't even in New York City. I mean, it was absurd. So it was one of those clear things where the extreme use of vulgarity, and I got my New York blood, would have been a warning sign not to hire the employee. Another case where a university was looking to hire someone, and in his Facebook picture, he was wearing nothing but a thong. I mean, I don't think if you're taking your kids, hey, we're going to school and you're going to meet someone, let's look up and see who you're meeting with today. Oh, you're meeting with Thong Man. It's not a good thing. So I told the client, print out the whole picture of the person, circle the whole picture, not just the thong, and say, that's why we didn't hire the person. Really bad judgment. So I think you can use it to diversify the applicant pool by looking in LinkedIn sites that are geared towards special groups that are underrepresented. And I think it's a big mistake on the early stage, but I think it can be incredibly helpful later on in the process. I look at it as part of the background check.
Wonderful. Well, Jonathan, this is Misha. But I'm glad you brought that, all those cases, which is really funny in some aspect, though. Well, as you talk more about the firing and hiring, you know, every time an employee is fired or hired, it involves cost. So, you know, over time, as things evolve, people get terminated due to various factors, right? It can be due to gender issue or ethnicity issue or even social media. So what if an employee sues an employer? So should an employer go and litigate or settle? What should be their first thought to go about?
Well, it's a great question, because that's the question that I think employers want to ask early on. Do you want to fight, or do you want to try to resolve it? And if you want to resolve it, you're usually, and I have to say usually because it's not always true, better off settling early. You don't want to spend a lot of money on your lawyer, my partners are cringing, and then settle the case later for what you could settle for early on. And it's not just the money. It's the time investment with the productivity loss. It's the emotional investment. So I think you have to make an initial decision, is this a case that I'm willing to settle? And you might be willing to settle because it would be too expensive to defend, purely economic. You might be willing to settle because although you didn't do something illegal, there could be the potential for there to be a perception of legal risk. There may be times where even if you want to settle, you can't. You know, I had a case where a client looked at the facts and they said, this is a really weak case, but we would probably settle it for $25,000. Well, that's fine, but when the other side asked for something in the vicinity of $1.8 million, the chance of settling went away. So sometimes it really does depend on whether the number that you're being, whether there's really an option to settle. But I think that's always should be the very first question. Do you want to fight it or do you want to try to resolve it? What's the client's business objective? You know, when an employer is sued, one of the things that employers are, they're on the defensive, but they now have to kind of recalibrate and say, what's my objective in this? Is it to fight and show the workforce that we do what's right, even if it costs some money? Or is it, this is not likely to result in a Me Too claim, let me make it go away fast, and then you try to resolve it. And the EOC has a very good, very, very good mediation program.
Great. Well, throughout your experiences and then the cases that you have dealt with, where do you see kind of risk areas and uptick in the next year where organizations should take care?
Well, I think we're going to see more and more cases involving boys clubs, this sort of invisible affinity group where there's a circle of powerful men that de facto run the organization. We already are seeing the boys club language entering some of the cases. You know, the cases in the early 90s were more about bad things being done, the harassment, and they still exist, but I think you're going to see more of the cases involving inclusion. Why am I not getting the assignments? Why aren't I part of certain leadership or other programs? So I think that's one thing you're going to see, more and more gender bias claims. We're seeing a strong uptick in religious accommodation claims, and employers need to understand that there's a balance there. Two very common mistakes. One, it has to be a sort of traditional religion, Buddhism, Judaism, Catholicism, Islam, but it doesn't have to be Presbyterian. The Church of Body Modifications may be considered. Vegetarianism may be. All it needs to be is a sincerely held religious belief. It's incredibly broadly defined, and the courts don't want to get into that. So if someone says, I have a sincerely held religious belief, I'm a member of, it's going to be hard to prove it's not sincere. The EOC has some good guidance on what you can do, but it's a pretty easy standard to meet. And then the second common misconception is, well, if someone has a sincerely held belief, it has to conform to his or her church, mosque, temple, synagogue, and that's not true. Someone could have a belief contrary to something like working on Sunday, even though it's not prohibited by his or her church. So I think there's a lot of room, and as our country gets more culturally diverse, I think we're going to see more religious discrimination claims. And then the graying of America, as you know, we see more and more older workers not retiring. Companies know they can't force them to retire. Some don't want to. Some can't afford to. And when they're let go, if you're let go at 30, there may be a legal wrong, but you say, you know what, I'm going to land on my feet. I don't want to burn bridges. I'm not going to sue. If you're let go at 65 and you think it's your age, you're more likely to bring a claim. So I think we're going to continue to see the number of age bias claims rise. And when you think about it, age is the only common denominator. We all don't think about being of another race or religion or disability, but every one of us knows if we're lucky, we get old. So I think employers need to be really thoughtful about how we're going to manage, really for the first time ever, a four-generational workforce. How are we going to make room for the millennials that want a seat at the table without pushing out boomers and traditionalists in a way that violates the law? And that's going to be, I think, a big challenge in the years to come.
Nice. In your opening, you mentioned prevention. And while we only have 4 minutes left in the show, I wanted to kind of get your take on what the audience should know about employment law and the relationship of prevention versus, I would assume, reaction.
it's a great way of framing it. You know, I learn so much from HR people and then feel like I can learn as I go along and through writing and speaking. But the prevention is in a couple of areas. Number one, it's hiring the right people and not thinking anybody is better than nobody. Number two, it's making sure that policies are clear in terms of what they require or prohibit and they reflect values. Number three, it's supervisory training on the do's and the don'ts. Not all of this is intuitive. Not hiring someone as a driver because they're blind is illegal. Not hiring them as a driver because they don't have a driver's license is legal. The average person might say it's opposite sides of the same coin. One is lawful, one is not. So then there would be training. And then I think a really critical part, policies, training, hiring, is when you see things in the workplace that are problems, resolving them as soon as possible. The biggest mistake that I see in terms of prevention is lost opportunities. You find out someone may have been working off the clock and you say, you know what, I'll let it go. What's the odds the employer will bring a claim? The odds may not be great, but if they do, it's going to be a class action. So preventive opportunities are lost every day because people play the odds. And the odds are you may not get sued, but if you get sued, you're going to get sued big. And I guess one piece of it is, you got to keep learning. I've been doing this 25 years. I enjoy your show. I like your tweets. I am on Twitter every day. Keep learning. Stay on Twitter. Read blogs. Listen to shows like this. Learn from other people's mistakes and then take it one step better. Figure out what's a negative in one company, make it a positive. So in this holiday season, where you know there's going to be inappropriate behavior at almost every holiday party that exists, think about what could you do that would change that dynamic. What if you said to people, you can drink, but you have to pay, but whatever you pay, we're going to match it and give it to charity. You come off philanthropic, charitable, and not cheap. And then the people who are most likely to cause a problem have to think twice about it, and if they do it, it's on their own dime. So there are a lot of ways that you can take negatives and, I think, turn them into positives.
Awesome. Well, my friend, we've got about a minute left in the show. What is your what's your Twitter ID, and we'll roll out to a little cure. And thanks again, Jonathan, for today.
Thank you. Thank you. My Twitter ID is Jonathan-HR-Law. And I have to tell you, for HR people, it's a lot of fun to be on Twitter. I'd like to follow HR people. I like to follow leadership mavens. I like to follow lawyers. And I'm a big fan of Mad Men, so I follow them a lot too. And the government agencies. Great way to find out what's going on. They often will tweet before they sue. So I'm constantly monitoring what they're tweeting about, sending it to my clients who think, here's my lawyer, my tweet of a lawyer with another tweet for the day. I'm like, if the EOC is saying it, OFCCP is saying it, it's top of their mind. I love how you opened, what's top of mind. What's top of the mind of government regulators is often what they're tweeting. 6 months later, it's what they're suing.
Wow. Well, everyone, have a wonderful day. Thanks for listening to Drive Thru HR. And again, thank you, Jonathan. And we are out.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely, my friend.